I tend to tell people that I'm not just a writer, that I do think of myself as someone in the compassion creation business. And I want to write stories that hold my readers' hands and walk them through, you know, the experiences of someone else. And those experiences are going to be positive, they're going to be negative, they're going to be traumatic, they're going to be joyful, they're going to be a bunch of things. But I hope by the time they get to the end, it's been an empathy enlarging experience.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Jamie Ford about his novel, The Many Daughters of Afong Moy, which, as Publishers Weekly puts it, concerns seven generations of women, all fictional descendants of Afong Moy, a real 19th century figure believed to be the first Chinese woman to come to America, who for years was exhibited at sideshows to paying crowds. In alternating chapters, Ford follows Afong Moy's fictional descendants while exploring themes of inherited trauma, ancestral pain, and love. Jamie Ford is the great-grandson of Nevada mining pioneer Ming Chung, who emigrated from Huaiping, China to San Francisco in 1865, where he adopted the Western name Ford, thus confusing countless generations. Ford's debut novel, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, spent 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list and went on to win the 2010 Asian Pacific American Award for Literature. His work has been translated into 35 languages. Having grown up in Seattle, he now lives in Montana with his wife and a one-eyed pug. Jamie, welcome to The Right Question.
Thanks for having me. It's so cool to be back.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you in studio. Okay, so Jamie, one of the reasons we're here to talk about many things, but the main reason we're here is to talk about your new book, The Many Daughters of Afong Moy. And Afong Moy is one of many female characters in your novel, and the titular character, obviously. She was a real person in 19th century Chinese and American history. Can you give our listeners a quick history lesson? Who was Afong Moy?
Yeah. Afong Moy, she was the first Chinese woman to come to America. She came to this country in 1834. She came under a cloud of circumstances. She never really... I mean, she was mentioned in the newspaper probably 200 plus times. She toured up and down the East Coast from Albany, New York, all the way down to Cuba. She had handlers that promoted her, and she was this great other. So people would buy tickets to go see her. She would speak Chinese. She would sing in Chinese. She would eat with chopsticks. She had bound feet, so she was definitely it's kind to say she was a spectacle. It's, you know, by today's standards, it's almost like she's a sideshow attraction in what we would perceive as, you know, a fairly degrading way. And yet she was celebrated, but she never expresses her own thoughts and feelings in print. It's always through her handlers who had a financial motive to have people come to see her. And so we really don't even know how she got here. We know the ship that she came in on, but it was illegal. I mean, all of this celebration of her in the United States obfuscates the problem in that it was illegal for Chinese women to leave China at that time. And the punishment was death. And so it's very likely that she was sold into this by her parents. Having too many daughters was seen as, you know, it wasn't, sons were an asset and daughters were a liability. And it's more likely that she was sold into this and never returned.
Mm-hmm. And the premise of this book is the many women in this book are descendants of will you
correct.
Pronounce her name again for me?
Yeah.
I just don't want to keep pronouncing it wrong.
No, this is just an aside. I say Afong. Mm-hmm. My publisher says there's like Afong, Afong, Afong.
Okay.
My publisher says Afong because there's a book, nonfiction book, written about her by an academic. Mm-hmm. She's a Caucasian lady. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how she determined that it was Afong. I don't think she did, but I have
a presumption.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I have relatives of that generation where that was pronounced ah. So I say Afong.
Afong. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, this book centers her not only her, but her descendants and those histories, those stories. But I want to stick with her and her relationship with you or your relationship with her. What is your relationship with her and how did you come to know about her? And how and when did her story integrate into your own?
Mm. I've known about Afong for a long time, probably 10, 15 years. I had thought about writing about her, but there's so little known about her. And there just didn't seem to be enough there to anchor a whole story. No one knows what ultimately happened to her. She dropped out of newspapers around 1849. There was speculation that she went back to China. There was speculation that, you know, that she died somewhere in a poorhouse. No one really knows what happened to her. And so I wanted to give her descendants and then explore the lives of those descendants. And that's where the story originated. That's it grew out of there. And I wanted to give her a legacy that was not just one of exploitation and tragedy. My relation to her is that, you know, she came over in the early 1800s. My great-grandfather came to this country in 1865, and he came, you know, as a worker. He was a miner in Nevada. And his wife, who was my great-grandmother, a woman named Loy Lee Ford. I got the name Ford because my great-grandfather's name was Min Chung, and he changed his name to William Ford.
Which was an immigrant's move. Many immigrants did that just to assimilate.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
Yeah, I always say it's like someone coming to this country from Pakistan and changing their name to Chuck Norris. Like, it's just like, let's get our America on. Let's do this. But I think he did it so that he could own property in Nevada, which was a territory, and it was not possible for Chinese people to own properties. But because of that, my great-grandmother became the first Chinese woman in Nevada to own property. She's in Nevada state history books. And so I know a lot about her. And I mean, that's a great thing. She's known for that. But her life was one of struggle, going from one mining town to another as those mining towns become ghost towns. And to be so removed from home. And I've been to Tonopah, Nevada, where she's buried. I've been there, and it's so dry and desolate and inhospitable that she must have felt like she had landed on Mars. Mm. And I mean, I get homesick just traveling for a weekend, and she left never to return. And so I guess I sympathize and empathize with the plight of my great-grandmother and the plight of Afong Moy for being so far removed, a stranger in a strange land, and then having to live her life in the public.
Yeah, and it sounds like your grandmother, was it your great-grandmother?
Great-grandmother.
Your great-grandmother and Afong, they share this this kind of tokenism, you know?
Totally.
They were both, you know,
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, you described Afong's life as kind of a sideshow. She kind of literally was. People came to see her.
Definitely.
Yeah, to see her bound feet. That's such an interesting, and an interesting is not the right word, but tragic. That is such a tragic inheritance. And I want to talk about inheritance because that is the larger theme of your book, right? The thematic thread in your book, apart from this family of women, is the idea of epigenetics.
Yeah.
The idea that human or that trauma and experiences are genetically inherited. In your novel, an indigenous doctor, Dr. Shedhorn, runs a clinic helping people understand where their family's histories, their traumas may originate. And she states at one point, as humans, we seek to hide trauma. I would love it if you could speak to maybe this broad idea of epigenetics, because I don't know that a lot of people know about it, or at least
sure.
Under that term. But that idea that we hide trauma and how your book attempts to illuminate those traumas in order to heal.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I first began writing this book and I was talking to people about what I was writing about, and I was explaining that I was writing about epigenetics or transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, they would just look at me, you know, glassy-eyed. And 3 years later, I can talk about this, and people will have had some contact in news or pop culture with what this is about. And it began in 2013. There was a study at Emory University where scientists, researchers, they took lab animals. In this case, it was mice, and they subjected them to a cherry blossom fragrance. And when they did that, they electrified the floor. And so they quickly habituated the animals to equate that scent with pain. And then what they found is 3 and 4 and 5 generations later, descendants of those mice who had never been shocked, who had never smelled that fragrance, when they introduced that smell to them, the mice had a panic fear reaction. So they had literally inherited that trauma, that one single traumatic event crossed 4 or 5 generations. And it's something that, I mean, it blew the minds of geneticists, but it also blew the minds of therapists who have felt this, believed this. I think in many cultures, whether it's the descendants of Holocaust survivors, and certainly indigenous people who've believed that and understood that inherited trauma is a real thing, and they're living with those effects. And so I wanted to explore that and look at how trauma follows the descendants of this one person, but also have readers pause and reflect on their own lives, the lives of their ancestors, and possibly see some causation or correlation of the pain and hardships in the past and how it affects them now. But also, as a sentimentalist myself, I wanted to think about what else we inherit besides pain and trauma. I mean, those are easier to see and measure because they manifest differently than love or joy and resiliency and things like that.
And you bring that idea into your characters too. There's one of your protagonists, one of these women, is someone who's struggling with her mental health, and it's always been sort of a question in her mind. Why? It's this static feeling that she can't really explain. There's nothing that she can attach those feelings to. And then when this idea of epigenetic inheritance kind of enters her life, she starts to grapple with that and try to understand if that's what's happening to her. You write into the future with this book.
I do.
You're writing into the past. You're writing into a relative present. I think the most recent is like 2014, but you're writing into the future, 2045. Mm-hmm. Because that then kind of enters the speculative fiction realm then, why did you choose to dip your toes into this genre? And I don't know, maybe you're not, but I consider you kind of a historical fiction writer. Yeah. Tell me about this new realm.
You know, the book definitely crosses a bunch of genres, which I mean, that's my own personal tastes, crosses a bunch of genres. From a, you know, pragmatic, plot-wise, you know, situation, I have the main character, Dorothy. She lives in 2045. It's a little bit into the future, a couple decades hence. And I did that so that the technology of today has been advanced just a little bit more for, story reasons to explore epigenetic inheritance in a greater detail than is currently understood at this moment. But I love speculative fiction. I'm known for writing historical fiction, but my short fiction is everything. So I've written crime noir, I've written middle grade horror, I've written erotica, I've written speculative fiction and dystopian and all these different things. Just I want to write all the things. But for this, I feel like this book is truer to who I am as a person and as a writer. And I didn't want to be boxed into historical fiction. And I felt the walls of that box closing in on me and getting closer and closer. And I just couldn't abide in that space. I wanted to write a bit more broadly, but also, you know, one of the book that that really made me want to be a writer was a book of speculative fiction, of short stories that was banned from my high school, written by a guy named Harlan Ellison. And now I own Harlan Ellison's first typewriter. And so I've always had this love for spec fiction. And this is, you know, me, again, dipping my toe in the water, but it's not the last that I will do this.
You describe it as, you know, it's enough into the future where there is technological advances,
yeah.
And even psychological, right? Like there's
totally.
there's things that are happening that are not happening in this world, but you can so easily imagine them happening.
You can almost touch it. I mean, it's
yeah.
like right there. And I've had early readers write to me. I'm like, I want this technology now because I have these things in my life and this would help or at least explain part of my journey.
What compliments that readers would be
yeah.
like, you've created this space that I want to inhabit and these things that I want in my life.
Yeah. I hope it's like Isaac Asimov, who wrote about satellites in the 30s and then, you know, he wrote about something that came to be. There is a part of me that hopes that, you know, 30, 40 years from now, there'll be some technology similar to this. Not so I can, you know, say I wrote a book that was somewhat prophetic, but just for my own mental health reasons, I would love to have access to that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with novelist Jamie Ford. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. If you'd like to listen to this conversation again or share it with friends, it's available online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You mentioned earlier that you're a sentimentalist, but you
yeah.
also like to write your characters as they're living their all their senses, their five
yeah.
senses. I listened or heard at some point an interview with you that you compared nonfiction to fiction. You said nonfiction is what happens, right? It is the
mm-hmm.
it is the factual events of things, and fiction is you're writing about how people feel.
Yeah.
How do you want your readers to feel when they read The Many Daughters of Afang Moy?
Yeah, this is where I tend to tell people that I'm not just a writer, that I do think of myself as someone in the compassion creation business. And I want to write stories that hold my readers' hands and walk them through you know, the experiences of someone else. And those experiences are going to be positive, they're going to be negative, they're going to be traumatic, they're going to be joyful, they're going to be a bunch of things, but I hope by the time they get to the end, it's been an empathy enlarging experience. And I think, you know, that's growing up as that kid who cried at sad movies and sad books. I mean, that's not exactly an asset to have in high school. You don't, mm-hmm. like girls aren't lining up to go to prom with the most sentimental, soft-hearted dude in school.
But they should be.
But all the things that I perceived as my weaknesses in high school became my superpowers as an adult and certainly as a writer. And so I lean into all of that. I just go there shamelessly because it's what I'm interested in writing about. It's what I'm always interested in exploring. You know, the human heart and conflict with itself is eminently fascinating to me.
Yeah. Epigenetics is not the only way that you allow your characters to explore their inherited traumas or the way that people actually affect one another, right? Like one of the epigraphs to the novel is, I saw that, and that was stated by karma. Is that was at least in the advance copy. Is that still in there?
It's still there.
It's still in there. I'm interested in writing, though, as storytelling. And I'm wondering how you see storytelling as part of these ideas.
Yeah. Even, you know, the light answer, I'll give you the light and the dark answer. The light answer is that part of my fascination with epigenetics was reinforced when my 12-year-old son was listening to Van Halen. And it was, he basically told me like, Dad, this is the greatest band in the world. He became obsessed with Van Halen. And he just found them on YouTube. And he had no idea, I hadn't played Van Halen for him, and he had no idea that Van Halen was my first concert ever in 1984 with, you know, David Lee Roth in leopard print spandex jumping all over the stage. And that seemed really odd and interesting to me. And then there are other musical similarities. And then, you know, when you have children, you see them becoming these versions of yourself in good and bad ways. The dark side is that, you know, if someone had asked me 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 20 years ago, what's your greatest fear? I would tell them that my fear was, I had this fear of being, it seemed like the most horrible thing that could happen to me personally would be to go to prison for something I didn't do. That seemed horrible. Like,
where did that fear stem from?
I just thought it came from movies. I remember seeing Brubaker as a small child. I remember seeing movies of, you know, this person who went to jail, you know, for a mistaken identity. And I think because of genetics have you know, have shown us that there's so many people who've been incarcerated because of, you know, a flawed witness or corrupt police, and genetics have exonerated people. And so I was interested in that, but I also found out 2 years ago that my dad, through my entire life, my dad's been gone for a long time now, but I was always told my dad spent 10 years in the Merchant Marine. He had tattoos everywhere. I was told there were sailor tattoos. My dad actually was in San Quentin and Folsom Prison.
Oh, wow.
And those are prison tattoos. And so I did have this extreme history in my own family that, not to say that, you know, that explains everything, because it certainly doesn't, but in my mind, I could sort of step back and go, oh, there's something interesting happening there, perhaps.
It seems so clear to me, and maybe I'm making a jump, but it seems so clear to me that, you know, your own history, you know, that it certainly drove the momentum of this book, that there, you know, that your own history with not only your great grandmother, but your father, that you are, you know, not only exploring the relationships between these characters, but in doing so are really exploring the possibilities of the relationships between you and your own family. Like you said the word lament earlier, and I thought that was such an interesting word to use. This might be, I hope, a good time to kind of hear from the book itself. Would you mind reading a passage from The Daughters of Afang Moy?
Yeah, sure.
Thanks so much.
This is from the first chapter, and it opens with a character named Fei Moy, and she's a nurse during World War II, and she's a Chinese nurse serving with the Flying Tigers in Kunming, China. And there actually was one Chinese nurse that that served that air group. She's not literally based on her, but just in case anyone out there is like, there were no Chinese nurses. Yeah, there was. There were Chinese aircraft mechanics. There's a lot of people, Chinese Americans, who've contributed to World War II history that are left off the pages of history books, and she was certainly one of them. Anyway, she is serving at this airbase. A pilot comes in. He crash lands. She helps him survive this crash. And he later perishes in recovery. And she finds herself drawn to him. And this is after he has passed away, and she is reconciling the circumstances of his death. An hour later, Faye took it upon herself to make the bed where the American had died in her arms. She changed the sheets and tucked in a freshly laundered wool blanket that smelled of lye. The broken glass had been swept, the old book returned to the place on a shelf. The only evidence of his death was the lingering redness beneath her eyes from when she'd walked outside, sat on the stone steps, and broke down sobbing. Now she wondered why she even cared so much and what she might have done differently. "I'm still going to recommend you for a citation," Dr. Gentry said when he left the hospital and found her there. "Believe me, you earned it." Faye didn't feel like she'd done anything special. She'd saved him only to watch him die hours later, hardly an act that was medal-worthy. "Why am I even here?" she rubbed her forehead. "I should be back in Canton looking for my parents." When she walked back inside, Lois found her and offered a small cigar box. I gathered up what little he had, his ID, a few personal effects. Fay nodded solemnly, and then took the container with both hands. Lois opened her mouth as though she were about to say something, then fell silent. She gave Fay a long hug, and then left her alone. Sitting on the nearest empty bed, Fay sighed and lifted the lid. She gently touched John Garland's dog tags. Then she sorted through a few notes, a faded flight map, a New York subway token, a silver pocket watch, a blue flight pin with a gold bar, a half-empty pack of Camel cigarettes, and his lighter. There was also an old leather wallet. Fay hesitated. The pilot didn't have a wedding ring, but still she expected to find a photo booth snapshot of some stateside sweetheart, some Rita Hayworth-esque girl, all curves and dimples. Instead, she found well-worn photos of smiling siblings and grim-faced parents. She took his pocket watch, which was old and tarnished, and held the heavy timepiece to her ear. The clockworks were silent, idle, dead. And she wound the stem. She felt the tension, and the spring hinge cover popped open, and Fay dropped the box. The room fell silent to her ears, all but the hum of a generator. Inside the watch was a photo clipped from a newspaper. The photo was of her, but she looked much younger, almost a teenager. She had no idea when or where the photo was taken. She'd never seen it before. Fay felt lightheaded. She turned the paper over. Written on the back, in her handwriting, were the words, "Find me." And much of the book, as we weave through all these generations, there's a sense of loss and longing, but also the sense of someone searching for someone through all these generations. And that's where the book trips a little bit into the realm of magical realism.
And it's such a joy. It is a trip. It is it's a wonder, and it's the maybe the more mysterious part of the book that you certainly
Early readers, when they post, "This book blew my mind," I'm like, okay, that's hit the bullseye there. That's what I was going for.
I mean, just from that point, and then obviously no spoilers, but to reach the end and to kind of see the full circle that comes from that point was beautiful. I mean, you spoke earlier about being sentimental and being someone certainly who cries in books and movies. That was me at the end of the book. It was an incredible through line, really.
Thank you. That's It's a far more complicated book than anything I've ever written. I have six point of view characters. I have six time periods. There's all this science. There's all this philosophy. There's all these things going on. And I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to stick the landing, you know? Even as I finished the book, I just wasn't sure. But the early readers, the reaction's been overwhelmingly positive, so I'm quite pleased.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that. Well, it's a beautiful book. Like I said, it's magical. I so enjoyed my own reading of it,
and you.
I thank you for it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I can't wait for MTPR listeners to read it too.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Jamie, thanks so much for being here.
Love it. My pleasure.
You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our sound engineer for this episode was Jake Birch. Our artwork was designed for The Right Question by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.